have each person introduce themselves, maybe just coming around this way. I'll present the basic questions that we would like people to speak to, and then you have your choice what you want to speak to or not, or if you think the questions are inappropriate and you'd rather talk about something else but that's equally interesting, that of course is okay. I'm used to students doing that on exams. If you ask them about X, they say, well, let me tell you about Y. It's more interesting, so we're used to that. So. Please.
Should I start? Does it work? Yes? Okay. No, so Jean-Luc Perron, he used to be the managing director of Grameen Crédit Agricole Foundation. So a foundation established in 2008 by Crédit Agricole under the inspiration of Professor Yunus. And the foundation is mainly dedicated to microfinance and social business. And within microfinance, we tended to give a high priority to the diffusion, the development of index-based insurance. And as so we invested, for example, in Acre Africa, besides Syngenta Foundation, and they have been a board member of Acre for 3 years, if I remember well. So today I withdrew from Grameen Crédit Agricole Foundation, but still paying a big deal of interest to this issue. So I can bring some pieces of my experience as a practitioner.
Thank you. So Tanguy Tufu, I'm the Chief Executive Officer of AXA Global Parametrics. So it's a relatively new entity within the AXA's galaxy. And our goal is really to simplify insurance, to make it more affordable, and to provide quick payouts. And basically, we are not only working in agriculture, we work in the energy sector, we work in construction, transportation. We always work based on parameters. So it could be rainfall, precipitation, solar radiations, vegetation indexes sometimes. It could be wave height, all types of parameters. And as mentioned by Madeleine, so we work with governments, we work with international institutions, but we work a lot with large corporations. We have some solutions for individuals, for SMEs, so across all types of clients.
So hello, everyone. I'm Asia Sidibe, head of West and Central Africa at the African Risk Capacity. So the African Risk Capacity, for those who don't know, I think almost everybody here knows what ARC is, but it's a sovereign catastrophe risk pool that is African. And so in terms of my intervention, I think I'll focus on, I have a few slides on the direction for the research for ARC and how Africa is thinking in terms of innovation.
Hello everyone, my name is Antoine Romidier from Airbus Defence and Space. We are data providers for insurance indexes, and more precisely we are working on grassland index insurance. So we are using satellite images mainly. Okay. Oh, sorry, just to precise that I am working on the research and development part of the project.
Perfect. Okay, so Daniel and I had suggested a few questions for this panel. One, actually, knowing we'd have someone from Airbus here, was your thoughts or anyone else's thoughts on the technological frontier for detecting crop losses or other kinds of losses, thinking particularly about remote sensing technology. A second question we sort of toss out, if anyone would like to speak to it, is whether there should be a set of accepted index insurance quality standards, and if so, how would you implement that? Regulatory requirements, a certification agency, does that make sense? How would you do it? A third question is, are there situations in which governments or donors should pay or subsidize agricultural insurance? And if so, how should governments or donors be thinking about making those kinds of investments? And the fourth is, and it really came up in our lunchtime conversations today, your thoughts from where you sit about the real research needs that you might have. What are the open frontiers? What are the questions that you see out there that we need, about which we need more evidence in this general area? So Antoine, since you're holding the microphone, if you'd like to speak to any or all of those, that would be great. And we'll sort of go around the circle here and take it from there. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. So I may start with the first one about technologies and next steps for better detection of loss. What I can say is that Airbus is on a digitalization approach, and we try to manage and to organize all the data we can collect from the different sensors with different resolution and different kind also of other data like meteorological data and all this kind of stuff like soil and different information. That's very important for us to be able to manage this kind of data. We have been leading our work with innovation. We have two kind of innovation. First one is about the calculation of biophysical parameter. You may know that we have one famous project that we commercialize in France. It's called FarmSAR, and it's about precision agriculture. And all these services is focused in is derived from this biophysical information. It means that instead of computing normalized difference vegetation index, we are deriving leaf area index or FARPAR information. It's all about characterization of the physiology of the plants. Second one is also about how do we try to create new projects and with who we are doing it. For example, I can cite the for the example of the grassland projection index in France. We have been creating research initiative with Grameen, Pacifica Insurance, and Airbus, and with academical context, we have developed this index to deliver some information for the framework, for the insurer in France. That's what I can say for this point.
Thank you.
Yeah. You can use these.
Okay, so I'm just going to go directly to the slides on research and innovation and how we see it for ARC. And I took the example of three of our research projects to talk to you about it. The first one is the Safari Research Project. So basically, we're having an international collaboration with the National Disaster Management Agency of Kenya, with AgriMet, who's the technical arm of SEALS, which is the committee for resilience issues in the Sahel, with the Imperial College of London, with the International Livestock Research Institute, and with WFP, who the World Food Programme, who also work on the issues of resilience. And as we know, when you we had the previous presentations where it was stressed that it's very important to have an accurate model. And for us, one of the priorities in terms of research and where we're trying to go in the future is really towards improving the accuracy of the model. So our model for drought uses the water requirement satisfaction index of FAO, built in the satellite rainfall data to combine information with the affected population and then get a series of events and the cost in the past of each of the events. So what we're basically doing is that we're defining the risk profile with the African governments with whom we work. So one of the things that we are looking forward to do is a toolkit and an assessment of the rainfall satellites. So for example, we've noticed that CHIRPS works better with some of the countries, depending on the region. And we are looking at it with Columbia University to see how we could eventually integrate it in Africa Risk View. Africa Risk View is the name of the software we use. And there's serious limitations and challenges linked to the timelines of the availability of data for CHIRPS. So this is one of the things that we're trying to do, because obviously when you have a model that is based on rainfall, you want to be as close as possible as to what you have on the field. And then real-time evapotranspiration as well. It's very important to better capture the impact of temperature. Extreme temperature is not well captured in our model. I think we talked also this morning about, you know, how a basis risk, basically. And the objective for us is to reduce the risk at the maximum. For young institutions such as ARC, if we have situations where there should have been a payout and there's no payout, or there's a payout when there's no drought, it's a significant reputational risk for us. And the last one is to revisit the drought model. So like I mentioned, we're using the WRSI, the Water Requirement Satisfaction Index. But we're also looking into other type of index such as VCI with Kenya, for example. We're looking at seeing if we could eventually integrate it into Africa Risk View, because for the Kenyan government, it's better aligned with what they're doing. Second thing is the robustness and sensitivity analysis. And it's not exactly standard for the industry, like what was mentioned, but we're definitely thinking that this is something that should be done. So we are working with the World Bank on having an analysis of our model and seeing how robust it is and how sensitive it is to the components of the model. And we also thinking about not a certification, but for us, when we do when we define the risk profile, we have what we call a contingency plan, and then we have very strict guidelines in terms of contingency plan. So we have a technical review committee that is composed of independent experts, and then we have our governing board of the ARC agency that actually has to certify the plan to say that the money will be used efficiently. So, and that's the biggest difference between ARC and the other pools, that there's a track in terms of how the money is used. And we've recently started to think about having the same thing for the model. So we're thinking about a kind of a customization review committee. It's still in design, but we definitely want to have standard as well for that. And the robustness and sensitivity analysis is a step in the right direction, because we're really trying to make sure countries are sensitive to what parameters make a big difference. For example, for some countries, you can see that the crop calendar, if you have a décalage, sorry, I'm French, in 10 days, it can make a big difference in terms of the level of payout. So all these things need to be assessed very carefully. And the last thing for research is multi-hazard. So we started with droughts because that was the main request from the African Union member states. But after the drought products, countries, especially in West Africa, pushed ARC to work on the flood model as well. And flood is very complex to model, actually. So what we have managed to do so far is a flood river-based model. So we're not capturing flash floods, and we're not capturing urban floods, because anyway, we don't think that urban floods should be insured. So it's a work in progress, but this is definitely one of the future access, because once you have covered the whole Sahel for drought, and once we, for example, for West Africa, the next layer of risk is flood. And we've seen that floods are happening more and more often, even in the Sahel. And finally, for innovation, I just want to talk about two main elements that I heard people mentioning, things that were related to it. The first one is licensing for development. So we have a program that is called L4D, Licensing for Development. And basically, it's to allow the use of the software to cover non-sovereign agricultural risk. So it's more of a meso approach to the insurance. And some of you have talked about it today. What we're really trying to do is to crowd in the private sector, because we think that if you have a better way to track the risks, maybe you will be more inclined to loan to the agricultural sector, and that's one of the biggest issues that we have in Africa. And but it's very difficult, and it's been mentioned previously, but first of all, you have to educate the banks and also the insurers, the local insurers, in terms of index insurance, and then there's cost associated with that. And then we've talked about the demand as well. So this is one of the projects that we have pushed forward, but we're struggling a little bit with L4D. And the next one is the Extreme Climate Facility. So it all started with Niger. So what we did with Niger is that we looked at the series of events from 1931 to nowadays. And what we have realized is that what was a one-in-five-year event in the 30s, for example, became a one-in-10-year event in the 80s. And what it means is that the cost of the insurance for Niger, given the change in climate, would quickly become, at the time, not really affordable. So then we said, okay, surely insurance is not the only solution. It's one of the tools. And it joins what was said before, but what we started to think was, well, if Niger had more programs in terms of irrigation and drought-resistant seeds, then they wouldn't have to take so much of the insurance. It would reduce the coverage needed, reduce the cost as well. So that's what the Extreme Climate Facility is. We are envisioning a facility where we would quantify the risk thanks to an extreme climate index that would trigger payouts to regions if the threshold in terms of the extreme climate index would be reached. And basically, it's just a way to quantify the risk and then to transfer it to the market. And we're still in the design phase for the index, but our idea would be then to use the money to be able to have the ARC countries that already already insured through the insurance company, also have access to adaptation fund, which is one of the biggest challenges also that we have. Okay, so I will stop here. Thanks.
Thank you. So,
Tanguy? Oh, sorry, Tanguy. Can I say one last thing on the premium subsidies, because it's the main subject for ARC? I just noted the question now, and I just wanted to say that in terms of premium subsidy for ARC, you know, premium payment has been a challenge because you work with governments in Africa, and even if some of them are sensitized to the issue of disaster risk and coverage and the cost of not having any protection mechanism, you can have a change in Minister of Finance, you can have many things that can happen that can jeopardize the whole program. And that's because there's not really a system in place. There's not really disaster risk management. There's no framework in the government for that. So we see it as more of a holistic view. It's not just about premium subsidies. We think there should be smart premium subsidies, but we also think that there should be holistic program in place to support government to have sustainable ways of having long-term mechanism. I just wanted to say that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So maybe a few words on the first question on the next steps in terms of research. From an insurer standpoint, I'm very confident, I'm very optimistic about the future of parametric or index insurance. If we take a step back, so basically started more or less 15 years ago, and we started with weather stations. So typically AXA worked with the World Food Programme in 2006 in Ethiopia. And at that time, we used 17 weather stations to cover a country with today around 100 million inhabitants. So of course, the basis risk was huge. Now we are using more and more complex algorithms. So NDVI was a good proxy a couple of years ago. Now I think we have more powerful algorithms, much more efficient with a lower basis risk. And again, if we look at the products that were developed 5 or 10 years ago, they relied on satellites that were launched in the 70s. So Landsat or similar satellites. Now we can count on the Sentinel satellites from the European Space Agency. So I may be naive, but I expect the basis risk to be reduced drastically in the next 5 years with respect to agriculture. For let's say, some disasters like floods, I think it's a different issue. But for agriculture, I expect crop models to become very efficient, very powerful, with almost no basis risk. And of course, we can also add some services, as you mentioned, to reduce basically the potential risk related to crops, and we can count also on some more resilient seeds to become much more resilient in the end. So I'm very optimistic. With respect to subsidies, I know it's a hot topic, and every time we participate to such a conference, it's something that pops up. I don't want to take any philosophical standpoint, but if we just look at agricultural insurance worldwide, it's the most subsidized insurance product. So it's the case in the US, it's the case in China, it's the case in India, it's the case in France, so almost everywhere. And for me, it's hard to understand why we should ask farmers in vulnerable countries. Basically, they have almost no money. The level of affordability is very low. How can we ask them to pay while farmers in the US are heavily subsidized by the government? So for me, even if I'm biased because I'm an insurer, I still think that subsidies make sense, at least for emerging markets. I think it won't work without subsidies, again, because they can't afford it. That's the main reason.
Okay, yes. Maybe I will elaborate a little bit about the issue of subsidies. Yes, of course, I share a view of Tanguy that, well, from a political point of view, I think there is no debate that if we compare the $8 billion dedicated to agricultural insurance in the US compared to some millions, I don't know even the figure, spent in all Africa, I think everybody should understand that compared to the question at stake, which is the food security for hundreds of millions of people, it's not a big deal in terms of international aid. Now the question is not only how much subsidy you put in place, but what kind of subsidy and according to what vision and what strategy you have in mind. And that's where we are maybe lacking a kind of a roadmap which could be shared between all stakeholders involved in the chain value. Index insurance is a very beautiful product, I would say, and I like it. And but it involves a quite complex structure of actors from the technology and data providers upwards to, of course, the distribution on the ground to the final consumer and beneficiary through a complex network of cooperatives, of insurance suppliers, of microfinance institutions, etc., and between, of course, the key role of insurers, reinsurers, and specialized operators like Aker, I mentioned already, which is designing a product and putting them in the market in the most appropriate way. So it's different compared to other types of insurance product in this regard. You don't, insurers cannot make it a success working in isolation. It cannot just depend on international financial development institutions either. It cannot depend on local distribution networks either. We need everybody on board, and we are lacking, I think, a kind of structure or platform or alliance of all these types of players to define a common roadmap in order to identify the key hurdles, whether are in the technology field or they are on the side of regulation or on the side of distribution or a combination of everything, but to clearly identify what are the main obstacles, gaps, which makes difficult to expand the uptake of index insurance for smallholder farmers despite all the benefits it could provide to the smallholder farmers, and to design a common roadmap with a 10-year vision, which is not common. Even the international institutions are working with projects with, I would say, a five-year time frame, and it's difficult for them to go beyond. But we need 10 years to build a market, because we don't have a market right now. We have a beautiful product. We have good news from insurers and from, I would say, the specialist of technology that, yes, it will be possible to reduce dramatically the basis risk, which has been the main obstacle to the diffusion and uptake of this type of products. But it's not the only question at stake. There's also a question of culture, of knowledge of from the side of the smallholder farmers. You know, this business is not a demand-driven business, as some of you, one of you mentioned to today. Nobody is wake up with the idea of buying an insurance product in developing countries. They don't have any idea about it. So we have to push that in the market in the most appropriate way. And that's where subsidies, yes, matter, because, of course, people will not tend to buy a product for an hypothetical risk with some kind of ambiguity in the mechanism, if on top of that it takes 10-15% of the capital insured at a time when they have no liquidity. So when we realize that, we realize that, yes, subsidies are necessary in one way or another, but provided that it's part of a policy on a long-term period, not only just for a particular project. Another point I would like to mention, which is not maybe among the questions you raised, but I think we need a kind of observatory of agricultural insurance worldwide. Of course, we are amongst more or less experts, so you more or less are all aware of what is on, what is working or not working, what is different projects have been developed in various parts of the world. But we probably need a kind of neutral place where all data could be collected, not only quantitative data, but also having a qualitative approach with some scientific and methods to have samples of farmers to measure the impact in terms of investment, increase income, and better off for the farmers. Of course, there are some ideas, but all these ideas don't respect any protocol, are not necessarily comparable. I think that if we were to have this kind of evidence in hands, it could help a lot to alleviate some resistance about the product. Now, about just your suggestion about standards, I think it's part of this policy. I think it's very much needed. There is a big risk that the potential of index insurance for farmers could be deteriorated if some players were to put into the market products which are not properly designed, which are not likely to in any way to provide the expected benefits, and which could create even a very bad image. Already, insurance is not popular in many developing countries. So we have to be very careful about that, and having some kind of label or some kind of standards to be respected in order to measure the effectiveness and cost effectiveness and basis risk linked to this product, I think is a very bright idea. But again, should be part of a global strategy involving all players and stakeholders.
So I guess I have a question for the panel, if that's okay. So under this new Centre for Global Disaster Protection, the UK government's committed £8 million to subsidise insurance. This isn't for micro-insurance. This is insurance for sovereign insurance, where an idea is a developing country government would partly pay the premium and DFID would support that. So I guess the question is, how should... So there was the point made that insurance should be subsidised. There is also the question of who should subsidise, and you know, do those institutions feel that they should subsidise? So DFID, for example, spends an awful lot of money, you know, saving lives, educating children, all these sorts of things. So why should DFID, you know, invest in insurance mechanisms as opposed to some of these other things they would do? And I guess, do you feel that the evidence base for investing in insurance, whether it be at the sovereign side, at the meso side, or the micro side for development agencies, do you think that evidence base is pretty strong at the moment? Or do you think there's a need to strengthen it? And you know, how should donors be choosing between different products? Because products can do very different things for very different people. How should they be making these decisions about how to allocate their money?
One suggestion that I would have is so we have lessons learned from that, right? Because I believe the CRIF, the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility, was heavily subsidized. That some countries until recently continued to get subsidies. So to your question, why should, for example, the UK subsidize premiums instead of responding to crisis? You know, I think, even better than me, but it's just cheaper than certain response. So that's why you said this morning that we're going towards risk management. But my suggestion would be to look at the lessons learned from previous subsidies and to draw the good things from it and to try to move away from what hasn't worked. In the case of the ARC countries, I think, you know, what is important is to support the countries without prevent the ownership that has already been built. And I think for that we can be creative. You know, there's been suggestions of digressive support where countries also have to commit to own some of the risk. I think this is probably one of the ways where we can do it. There are many solutions. We could think about guarantees for countries who've been paying the premium for a few years and have a accident, and the year where they're supposed to have a payout don't pay because it happened, and it's actually it makes us move 10 steps backwards, and so I think there's a way to do it, and I believe there's a working group at Insure Resilience that is actually working on this, and that's meeting almost every 2 weeks. And on our side as well, we are working with the African Development Bank and with DFID and others to see what could be the best mechanism for that.
Maybe just a comment, maybe also to trigger some discussion. Of course, the technology of index-based insurance is in common between the macro level, and the ARC is a very good example, the meso level in the sense, because meso insurance is used in different meanings, but in this case, I suppose we are talking about portfolio insurance for, say, microfinance institutions or banks, and for individuals. I think that, in my view, that there could be a temptation for the donors to say, okay, we'll do that just for the top of the pyramid, in meaning it will be easier to put in place such mechanism at the sovereign level or with institution we already know, and then there will be some kind of benefit for the ultimate beneficiaries, the smallholder farmers. I say no. Well, we are in a time where we are talking a lot about adaptation to climate change, and the people who will suffer from climate change are smallholder farmers. There are 400 million small farms of less 2 hectares in developing countries. It's huge, and they provide 70% of the food consumed in these countries. So if we don't deal with this issue, if we don't provide these people directly and not only indirectly the benefit of some kind of protection by through insurance and before the shocks and not after the shocks, I think we are missing our mission.
Yeah, I could just come back to the point on certification or standards. For an insurer, I don't see how it could work, because most of the time we design new products, so it's tailor-made, depending on the type of crop, depending on the geography, depending on our client's needs. So it's very difficult to see any kind of standard. There could be some standardized algorithms like NDVI, evapotranspiration, FAPA, as you mentioned. But apart from that, I guess it's every time tailor-made. Then there could be some institutions certifying that the insurers are doing a good work. But honestly, for insurers, we don't want to damage our reputation, so we do our best to make sure that there is a strong correlation. And of course, if there is no strong correlation, we won't offer any insurance products. Otherwise, we could be, perceived as not doing our job properly. So for us, I don't think there could be any standardized product. I don't think it would be the case in the near future. Certification, why not? But it should be very quick, so we should not wait for 6 months before to get a kind of stamp. Otherwise, of course, it will be a failure. But practically, it may be quite challenging to make it happen. But maybe you have some good examples or some good good ideas around that.
I mean, my own thinking on that is that in many instances, this is still a fairly immature technology. And I think a lot of products were rolled out with sort of fairly simple crop growth models without a lot of, and based on CHIRPS data or other things, without a lot of understanding whether those are really very reliable predictors or not. So I think, particularly at this stage of development, till we get better, and I think the developments are happening very, very quickly. You know, I think there's, at least as we try new ideas out, and maybe this is especially a message for donors, maybe more than the private sector, but if a donor wants to encourage the use of FPAR or whatever kind of based measures, that maybe there's a need to slow down a little bit and collect a little bit of the on the ground data that's useful. I mean, to mention the index based livestock insurance in northern Kenya, when we initially designed that, we actually had about 10 or 15 years of data from prior research projects that we were able to use to sort of say, actually, this worked tolerably well. We actually have, through the RCT process we've gone through, we have 5 more years of data, and we just commissioned a small study that ran a horse race between 2 much more sophisticated, sort of more modern versions of the indices that have been done by a couple of different European university people. It's very interesting to look at the uptick. But I mean, so in that sense, I think it's kind of important to do it. And what I mentioned as a safe minimum standard is just using some basic economic concepts about when is insurance worth purchasing or not. It's just a way of aggregating together that, you know, you could look at failure probabilities, but there's a little bit more to it than that. So, one doesn't want to gum it up. You don't want to slow down innovation. But on the other hand, at some point, I think because it is a little bit of an immature technology, I think at least in some instances it's worth checking on that. And, and I think we're maybe at that stage where it's worth doing just a bit more of that.
Yeah, so I think on this issue of sort of the reliability of the index, I think there is a difference as to whether you're selling a product to, you know, an illiterate farmer, a corporate, a sophisticated corporate, or a government. So index insurance products are typically called index insurance products, but they're often structured as derivatives. And particularly, I think the sort of experience of retailing these products to low-income households is that, you know, those households don't necessarily... They're not necessarily very good at reading the policy wording and working out whether it's good or bad. So I think in that case there is potentially a strong argument for trying to make sure that these are reducing risk, not increasing risk, particularly if they're supported by governments or donors. Corporates, you know, largely can probably take care of themselves. Governments, it depends. I think, you know, when ARC develops your indices and customizes your indices, yes, you work very closely with governments, but you also bring your own experts in to protect your reputational risk because, you know, this is still relatively new for them. And just one final comment, particularly on the government side. So typically when you would sell an insurance product in, you know, the UK or France, you would have key policy wording at the front, which would say this is what the insurance product is doing. When you sort of retail index insurance or parametric products to governments or to individuals or corporates, typically you wouldn't have key policy wording, and that can lead to a misunderstanding where the client thinks they're buying something, but actually the details of the contract are slightly different. And this may be no fault of the insurance company. It may be they feel like they've explained it 20 times, but still the client just doesn't understand. They thought they would be protected for anything that would happen, but it was the wrong kind of earthquake or the wrong kind of tropical cyclone or something. And I think this whole issue of if we're going to call it insurance and offer it to governments or to individuals, you know, that there is, you know, there's a greater burden, I think, on the seller of insurance than if you're selling it to sort of quite sophisticated corporates.
Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to react to that. So in the case of ARC, before a country can go to the insurance company and buy the insurance coverage, the company, which is called ARC Limited, is not allowed actually to sell a contract until the agency has kind of provided what is called a certificate of good standing. So that's basically the board saying that the government has gone through a capacity building program, the government experts understand how you define your risk profile, and they understand parametric insurance. And then there's a contingency plan that we trust to for the use of the money. But to your point, you're right, because only after three to four years that you start to have country experts that are really that really understand how it works and the sensitivity of the models, and also the everything linked to attachment points and triggers. And the insurance contract, I mean, you are from the insurance world, but for a non-insurance person, reading a parametric insurance contract is quite complicated. So I think there's definitely a need for support from the donors in that sense.
Just some information from the project of Grassland in France. We have some works of validation to do and to present at scientific committee leading by the government, because the project is subsidized, and also experts from modeling, agronomy, and all different disciplines. So we have to present our results and how we manage basis risk with the index every year, how we improve the index each year. So this step is very important for the development of the product. We have to pass this like an exam, because it's important for the different farmers to be sure that the index they will buy correspond to what they will experiment on their field. So that's important to do. But I agree with Tanji about the difficulty to replicate and to create one protocol available to validate each kind of products on each kind of crops. It could be very, very difficult, I think. And the other thing is, how do you collect data to validate this this information? And this is one main issue we have to deal with in France, because of grassland. Grassland is consumed on the farm, eat by the cattle or just cut and to feed the cattle. So we have no information of production, and we have a big issue to get information on validation data.
And I, you know, just reflecting on that a moment, I mean, for crop insurance in the United States, there's also a set of hurdles and ratings of the contracts and experts' opinion. I think the problem we see, you know, when I'm working in Tanzania, for example, the data aren't there, right? And that's what I mean by sort of being careful. What I presented today was we said, well, let's slow down. Basically, we delayed ourselves by a year, and we tried to create retrospective data. It's not great data, but if you're careful about it, you can get some ideas of what's going on at different communities. And then you can actually look and design the contract. I mean, we've actually gone through entire suites of different kinds of things. I mean, in this current contract I mentioned, we're actually relying on NDVI, but for whatever reason, that turned out to be a better predictor than a number of other sort of higher order indices for that environment. I'm not generalizing, I'm just saying. And that gave us confidence that, you know, we had something that we could do. But, you know, again, in data sparse environments or where, you know, you may have data on the index going back, but you may not have data on the farm level outcome and losses that you do have in European and certainly the U.S. context that can be used to take the exam, so to speak. And so, anyway, they are challenges, I think. So I think we have a few more minutes left here. Should we open it up out here to the audience? I'm not, if anybody would like to chime in on any of these questions. But say something provocative, like electrify.
Yeah, actually, it's about what you presented. I forgot the name, failed contract?
Fail safe.
Okay, fail safe. I was wondering how... So obviously you had to price the moral hazard of people SMSing you that, you know, you're the like all of that. And I was just thinking how this could also be useful for us. And I was telling my colleague there that I see potential in that. But my question is actually related to the pricing of the premium because of this additional safeguard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean in particular, there is a potential moral hazard problem. We think we know the solution, but we haven't bothered to try to implement it yet because it may not work. Okay, so I think the simple solution would be to say, if a bunch of farmers SMS and we undertake the expense of visiting the area and doing a crop cutting kind of exercise, and it proves not to have been justified, then somehow you want the farmers to pay, right? Now, the question is, how do you do that? How do you actually enforce that? The sort of typical economist response would be the farmer or the farmer association has to post a bond, okay? And they sort of put some of their cash aside, and it's sitting in an escrow account of some sort. And if they ever demand an audit that's not at all justified, I mean, let's give them 5% or 10%. So if the trigger is 60% or less of yields, of normal yields, and they demand an audit, and you see it's more than 70%, then they pay, something like that, right? I mean, so far, we're not sort of far enough down this road that has become a problem where people say, oh, let's demand an audit just in case, right? But it could be. So, one would have to think long and hard. And especially the reason I'm sort of critical of the idea is you're talking about highly resource-constrained farmers. Telling them to post a bond does not sound like a very good idea. But in terms of how it was priced, we've actually experimented ourselves, and we know roughly how much it takes to go to a location with an agronomist who knows how to do this, and we've trained a few people to do this, and we know roughly the probability that event will take place, and then we know how many times that it, if there's no moral hazard, how often it will take place. So you can sort of work it into the arithmetic, and I mean, I was, when we passed that on to our reinsurance company, I was holding my breath as to whether they would throw up on the idea or not, but they actually saw the sensibleness of it. And so I think it's ultimately a really good kind of marketing tool. I mean, back to issues of trust, I mean, I've seen my colleagues in northern Kenya explain satellites and NDVI to pastoralists with a 1 year's worth of education, and I'm not sure how well it actually works. But if you do have a kind of backup mechanism that says, okay, you may not understand or trust that, but if you feel your losses are genuinely large, then send a message, and we'll send out a real person who's going to, do things in the space, into the units of measure that you actually do understand. So it's something I think one can work towards. But again, it requires that, back to this lack of data, for us to have been able to do that, we actually had to go and collect this retrospective data so we could actually historically see what would have been the failure rate of the contract that we were proposing. And we designed the best contract we could, but it's still not, it still fails as you would anticipate. So, I'll pass it to you so I don't talk anymore.
No, it's okay. It's a question to each of you, just a short one. How many farmers have you been able to serve up to now? And my congratulations to Professor for mentioning the 4.3 million farmers served through the Cadena program, because that is a milestone. And we're talking here for hours now for everything about weather index insurance and so on. But how many farmers have been served, and where are the products? I think the only one on stage that can really talk about this is Jean-Luc Perron, probably. But I do expect from all of you just to give me just a figure and a few products.
Challenge accepted. So I guess in terms of headcount numbers, my main contribution, so my first job when I joined the World Bank was working on agriculture insurance in India. So there the government had essentially a compensation scheme that was implemented through a public insurance company, which didn't actually bear any risk. Government just sort of provided the money. And at the time it was serving about 13 million farmers. And they moved to a public-private partnership, which tried to crowd in commercial insurers. And by the end of the project, there were 30 million farmers insured. So I guess the difference between those is 17 million. Now, there are questions about product quality. So one of the, there's a World Bank paper which looked at the relationship between the payouts from the insurance and the area average yield. And it found a correlation of 13%, 13%, when you know you'd want it to be sort of 70 or 80%. So it's missing a lot. So there are some issues with the design of whether an insurance product. And this was very heavily subsidized, and it was compulsory. So if you're a farmer in India and you want to take out a loan for agricultural production purposes, the insurance comes with a package. So I'm not sure whether I can really claim any credit myself, but you know, I was involved with it. But
Well, just about our experience, so we have been involved and the stakeholder, shareholder of Acre Africa, and we develop Acre for now four or five years, and the outreach is about 400,000 farmers, smallholder farmers.
1.3 million farmers.
How many?
1.3 million farmers.
Okay, so you made a big step forward. Okay, it's a nice development. And Acre has been able to design products which have proved to be well adapted to some kind of some categories of smallholder farmers, as for example, the replanting guarantee, which is a very simple product because, once again, taking into account the educational problem, we have to put in the market very simple products, easy to understand for the farmers. So the replanting guarantee, as you maybe know, when the farmer goes to a shop and buys a pack of seeds for maize, 2 kilo, for example, he's back to his farm. Then he opens the pack, he finds a card with a registration number and a call number and a number to be called. So he gives a call, he gives the registration number, and it triggers the geolocalization of his farm. And it triggers a period of 3 weeks during which he's supposed to sow. And if during this period of 3 weeks the index does not trigger the indemnity, during this time there is no indication of lack of rain. If there is an indication, so he gets an indemnity equal to the price of the seeds, and he can try again to sow. So, and we have been supporting also the assurance record sale, which has been developed in Western Africa by Planet Guarantee in four countries mainly. Four countries: Senegal, Mali, Burkina, and to a lesser extent Benin, with about 30,000 farmers insured, which is relatively disappointing compared to, of course, to the overall population. So we have still a lot to do to scale up.
So it's a quite complex question, so it depends on how you count. So for AXA, for example, we provide some capacity to Cadena, to farmers in India, to AICI, for example, to Bharti AXA. If you just take India, we can expect around 30 million farmers to be insured this year. We provide some support to the Africans' capacity too, so I don't know if you want to include them in the count. We work with the World Food Program in Ethiopia. We work directly with NUCNAS in Senegal, insuring around 40,000 farmers. So we participated to the to a deal with the World Bank in the Philippines that were what was official. 2 months ago. So we insure farmers, but also basically the government against typhoons and earthquake. So if you add up all the different deals, and sometimes we only have like a 3-10% share in a very large scheme, I think we are above 50 million, definitely.
Okay, thank you. So ARC Limited, the first pool was inserted in 2014, so we're at the fourth pool now in 2017. And in terms of how many people were supported through the payouts, it's 2.1 million people. And 800,000 cattle. So that's for four countries and $34 million total in payouts for the now 4 years. But we haven't finished the second season. We haven't seen the East Africa season yet. And the total coverage is more or less $450 million. Okay. And then there's eight countries in the pool.
I don't know if you're interested also about grassland in France. That's I'm the little one of the the panel. It's about for the second year in France. It's about a few thousand of farmers.
And Michael cannot be judged by the number of farmers. I think he's an academic, so he's got a different homework question, I think. But you can.
Well, actually, Daniel can probably help me out on this. So this, the index-based livestock insurance program that we started in northern Kenya, I think currently enrolls around 3,000 farmers. So I feel very short compared to some of these other numbers. That program has been picked up by the government of Kenya. And Daniel, you know more about the CLIP program. I think it's currently covering what, around 40,000-50,000, something like that. I mean, they're sort of slowly scaling it up. In terms of the cotton insurance work we've done in Burkina, we had a pilot area that was relatively small, sort of research-sized, but we're actually in the process of giving technical assistance to scale it up for the entire set of cotton farmers covered by Sofitech. And I'm sitting here scratching my head trying to remember. It's about 80% of the farmers who grow cotton in Burkina Faso, so maybe somebody knows how many. I'm not remembering how many people that is potentially, but that's sort of what we're sort of heading towards there. Other questions? Anybody want to jump into the discussion here?
Hi. So I just have a question about just for your perspective on whether you think that index-based insurance is sort of more of a leapfrog innovation in terms of developing insurance markets, or do you think it's more of a building block towards the traditional indemnity-based insurance markets that exist in developed countries?
So my conviction is that we will be able to parameterize to some extent traditional insurance products. So, for example, 2 weeks ago, we launched a new product to cover our clients against a flight delay. So the parameter is the number of minutes of delay on a specific flight. And we're able to pay basically within 90 seconds. So it's based on some blockchain technology. But as soon as your flight lands, we can trigger the process. And then it's automatic. And let's count around 90 seconds to make it happen. So if we take Harvey in the US as an example, it's a massive failure for the insurance sector. So basically, you can expect people to be paid within 2 to 3 months because there is a lack of loss adjusters. So even if your house was completely destroyed, you may have to wait 2 months to get some payout, which is something which is not acceptable, of course. So I expect some innovations that were fueled by emerging countries to become more and more popular in the most advanced markets. It's the case already in the US, in some European countries. It's the case in China. So I honestly think that the most innovative country in terms of parametric insurance by far is China, based on WeChat technology, Weixin in Chinese, based on Alipay, based on different technological players, which are much more sophisticated than what we can find in the US, for instance, or in Europe.
Anyone else like to speak to this?
So my view is for governments and development agencies, I think this is a leapfrog technology, but it's not leapfrog in terms of developing the domestic insurance market. It's about public financial management. It's this issue of what else, how else can you financially plan and pre-commit finance? And your main alternative is putting money in a pot. And it's very difficult not to spend that money when you have a medium-sized event. So I think it's a disciplining device, and I think that can be a leapfrog. And on for corporates, yeah, I think this can be a leapfrog as well. For households, I think it depends, and I think it depends what government's doing as well. You know, there are some countries where you've had a number of institutions offering products, and some of them have failed. And that has brought the insurance industry into disrepute more generally. People don't trust the insurance company because they feel that the insurance company has not done what they felt it should. They paid it to do. So I think there are risks and opportunities in the micro space.
I think that's a great question. I mean, when you were first asking it, my initial thought was this is not a leapfrog. This is not going to take people from where they are to sort of more conventional forms of insurance, because at least in when you're talking about 2-hectare farmers, conventional forms of insurance just aren't cost effective. I mean, the loss adjustment costs just swamp anything that's conceivable. And so that was sort of my initial response, is it's just something different that's reflecting the scale and the risk that people are facing. On the other hand, Antoine and also Tange's comments and sort of the rapid advance of this technology suggests a different way of thinking about it, that it maybe it really is a leapfrog. You jump completely over the period of standard loss adjusted insurance, but in fact maybe you begin to replace, you know, U.S. agricultural insurance, as I understand it, is largely loss adjustment based, and yet with very high resolution satellites, you see what's being done in precision agriculture. You can move towards types of individual insurance. They might still have some loss adjustment if the scale of the producer is large enough to warrant it, but you can get good signals. I worked for a while with people in a private company who were remote sensing experts, and they were very proud of an example where they were working with a U.S. Hail insurance company. It was getting lots of claims would sort of come rushing in, and they had satellite-based measures. I don't remember what they were based on, where they thought the hailstorm actually was, and they just they triggered some automatic letters to people saying, "We've just received your claim for hail insurance. According to our, you know, our best information, the hailstorm was approximately, you know, 3 kilometers from your farm. Please explain." And it's the insurance company liked that a lot because it led to a lot of retraction of claims. But I mean, I think there are actually some very great possibilities. And in a sense, what I was hinting at today is, you know, downscaling, you know, as more and more precise information becomes available, you know, sort of downscaling index insurance towards the level of the individual farmer. You still need to worry about moral hazard kinds of issues, but I think it's becoming increasingly likely that becomes a possible kind of monitoring and payout kind of technology. So, please.
Thank you. Hi, everyone on the panel. So, Clémence Vidal, I'm a operations officer in AFD's urban development team. I wanted to kind of react to a comment made by Asia, saying we don't believe urban floods should be insured. And so that kind of leads me to Michael's question earlier, where does index insurance make sense? Asking whether you're aware of either research programs or pilots where these kind of products have been developed for the urban poor, ensuring household assets, productive assets, and whether you think that there's some feedback already from such research programs, and whether you think it does make sense in urban settings.
I can just tell you from the experience in the cities, the big cities in Africa, and especially in West Africa, most of the time the urban floods can be big part of the risk. People located in the wrong area, and then the gutters that are not clean. So when the local governments take this measure to prevent the risk, there's no need for insurance. Insurance, that is our perspective. Insurance is quite expensive, and if you can use other measures to reduce the risk, then you should do that before you go to insurance.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty challenging, and, you know, developed countries find this difficult as well. I mean, you've got a lot of flood insurance schemes, earthquake insurance schemes that are pretty difficult. To the best of my knowledge, they're pretty much all indemnity-based because they're all trying to protect individuals against their homes. You know, this point about basis risk, you know, if I'm insuring my home and it gets hit by a flood, I'm not going to be happy if there's only a 50% chance I'm going to get a claim payment from my insurance company. That's just not acceptable because a house is a really big thing. And my bank is probably not going to take that as acceptable either. I think that there might be opportunities in doing innovative things and having innovative indices. I know there have been some experiments recently the World Bank's been supporting where for flood insurance for homeowners, you have a sort of combination approach. So you'd have a parametric trigger, but then you would go and measure to see where the maximum water level was for the flood based on actually going and visiting places. And then everyone within that area would get paid based on the property and the relation to just the height. So you wouldn't look at damage for a building. You'd actually go and measure the height. So there are some things that you could potentially do. And there's maybe not, you know, enough innovation in this area as there should be. But it's quite challenging. And just flood modeling is pretty challenging in general, as you probably know.
Anybody else want to comment on this? So I saw a question over here. Yeah.
And then we'll come back. Yeah, it wasn't actually a question. It was more of a comment to the earlier question that was brought up about the numbers. And I think we should kind of go beyond that and not just look at the numbers, but look at the actual impact, because I can cover 2 million people with a sovereign scheme. But in the end, if everyone, like, what does that mean in terms of how much people actually get and what they get? What impact does that have? And we know very little about that. So I think we should pay more attention to the impact rather than only the numbers. Thanks.
Anyone care to?
Well, I mean, to some extent, the easiest way to get headcount these days is to partner with a mobile operator, have a product that is so cheap that the coverage is not necessarily, you know, you're not going to get paid very much, and people don't necessarily know that they're protected, so they won't claim for it either. And then you can claim very large amounts of headcount. But, the impact you're having is not necessary. So I think that this, you know, headcount is really important, but there are other metrics, particularly for development agencies, to try to make sure, you know, but, you know, there are other metrics which are important as to, you know, proxies for whether the insurance is, you know, protecting.
And I think related to that, I think it ties in very much to a programming issue. Alan, for example, suggested that it's the behavioral response to risk reduction which may be generating lots of the benefits. And yet, if, as Daniel just said, if folks don't know they're protected, then obviously they're not going to change their behavior, and it's not working. And I think that is kind of an important, you know, design, which is not to make light. I mean, if you only get half of the benefits because it's ex post stuff, and maybe Alejandro, that's what was coming out of your work, you know, kind of seeing reactivation quickly, that's obviously very, very important. But maybe it's only half the potential benefit, but maybe that's the best we can do in some instances.
Yeah, in fact, I would have one question linked to the, when we talk about smaller farmers or co-ops, I mean, in the various programs that you said support the developments of the insurance capabilities in developing countries, is there a big amount of money that is built in to help reinforcing, you know, capacity for those, this population to understand? How much is it, you know, as a proportion? I mean, how much is it? And I'm wondering whether, when you look at the difficulty we have in some countries to get, you know, the basic electricity, you know, for example, and now in the Sahel countries, you know, 75% of this population being rural, so concerned by the issue, you know, all those populations currently living in a context of insecurity, where it is rather difficult to access them, to provide them with this sort of content, you know, how much is basically dedicated to train, to inform, and to make sure those guys see it as a viable solution?
No, you have no answer about the figures. I have no idea about it. There is probably a capacity building component in many programs, for example, from the GIF, Global Insurance Facility, Index Insurance Facility. I just would like to stress a point that, yes, probably this education should start with intermediaries, with structures like co-ops, like microfinance institutions, which have the capacity probably to then to diffuse the message and to convince the people with because there is more trust towards these entities compared to government agencies or international donors or insurers, sorry, Tanguy. So probably it's the best way to start this educational work, which is absolutely necessary, because at the end of the day we need to have this product in place at a very large scale.
I just wanted to add, so I don't have the numbers in my head, but in terms of how we work, so you have the insurance company, but the agency's role is actually to provide capacity building, because as I explained before, we're not allowed to sell insurance if we don't think that there's a level of understanding. So there's a lot of resources that have been put by the UK, by Germany, by France, by Canada to in making sure that there's a capacity building program. But it is mostly going to educate the civil servants because it's a sovereign product, right? But what I wanted to say is that when we had the payouts in the Sahel in 2015, you had some of the countries had organized village assemblies because the money went to the most vulnerable population. So they were in villages to with the chief of the village to talk to them about the insurance and why it's important. But again, it's very difficult because you're talking about extremely vulnerable population. And then what we have also realized recently with the lessons learned from 3 years of implementation is that there's also a level of we also need to provide capacity for parliaments because when you work at the states level, parliaments are extremely important. And in Africa, parliaments are not educated in this field.
So you asked for controversial a few minutes ago, Michael, to wake everybody up. So maybe I'll most of the micro programs I've seen have really tried to do this because it's important to get demand. I think one important metric, which I think we don't talk about very much, is, you know, if, for example, a development agency wants to invest in micro-agricultural insurance, how much do they have to pay per policy that ends up being sold? And then what is the renewal rate? So how frequently, you know, who buys after year two? And not a lot of programs publish these figures. So the latest figures I have, and I think I should say, you know, maybe people in this room are not representative of these figures, but it costs something like $50 per product sold, and the renewal rate is about 5%. And now, so it's being promoted. So there is a lot of work done to try to get the products being offered, but you know, this is quite expensive because people are not familiar with insurance. They live in remote areas. You know, where the maths can make more sense is, and again, so there are lots of counterexamples to this, but you know, in terms of this being scaled up outside of sort of, you know, these are the numbers I've seen. So where this can get a bit cheaper is if this is part of a sort of public policy. So if you're getting lots of free marketing through government, so if, you know, political leaders and the news are sort of talking about this as being part of government's planned response. And, you know, obviously we see compulsion in many markets in China and in India for the micro side. But I think this, you know, this sort of educating consumers to be able to make informed decisions on derivatives is pretty complicated. And I think this is where, you know, for development agencies, you know, who are pretty ruthless about how they allocate their development money, you know, there is a question about you know, how to allocate money between these different areas, and in terms of, you know, it might be easier, for example, to educate, or not educate, but to train some people in ministries of finance, which can then come up with a solution that benefits 100,000 people than doing door-to-door sales for 100,000 people, unless you've got a really good distribution network already that you can sort of tie into.
Well, I think we have reached the end of our time for this session, and I think we have a short wrap-up planned. So thank our panelists for their contribution.
So thank you. It's the time to conclude. And this workshop was very fruitful, and for us as a development agency is quite interesting to listen and to confront the the views and the research results with the actors' experience. And among the many ideas that were shared this afternoon, I would like to pick two of them that are meaningful for us as a development agency and on which we can add also, we can have an added value. The first one is that for catastrophic and index insurance tools to work, the building the appropriate institutional framework at the local and the national level really, really matters. And the second idea is that when a natural disaster hit a country or a region, it's really important to be able to react quickly. And the prerequisite for this is to have already set up the tools before the natural disaster hit. So this is meaningful for us, and we need to work on this kind of prevention tools. So this is the two ideas that I wanted to share, and that we are meaningful for us. So thanks a lot for all these exchanges.
So you've heard from me an awful lot. I'm sorry. So I've been working in this area for a while now, and I'm continually impressed at the depth and the breadth and the thoughtfulness as this area grows. And I'm quite pleased to see people with quite different professional and institutional backgrounds. I think back when I started working in this area, when I started working for the World Bank, it was a team called Insurance for the Poor, and it was a bunch of insurance economists. No, this is no offense to insurance economists, but this topic is bigger than just insurance economists. There are roles for a lot of other people, a lot of other stakeholders. So it's good to see, you know, quite a diverse group of people here. I think we're still in early days. So, you know, a lot of the researchers, you know, particularly, you know, the researchers who've presented, you know, this is really cutting edge stuff. This, you know, it's important to keep on pushing these boundaries. It's important to keep seeing whether things that practitioners think are good ideas are actually good ideas, to see whether things are working. It's also important to dream about what might be possible, which people haven't thought of yet. And that dreaming is a participatory process that you need a number of people in. So it's been a pleasure as always. So my new job involves hanging around events like this. So please do invite me in future. And I promise not to talk quite so much. But, you know, I've learned a lot from being here. I think the one point that the one reflection that comes out of this for me. So I remember seeing a presentation back when I was a PhD student that argued that development, if you think about it, is not about developing better solutions. It's about developing better feedback loops, because development is messy. And what you want is you want to try to get towards better solutions, but you don't do that by developing the perfect solution. You do that by developing better feedback loops. And I think, you know, what I've heard particularly from the economists here is that it's important to keep on looking at what's working, what's not working, changing what you're doing. You know, this whole issue of, you know, is the product doing something that's economically useful? The question of how does it link into systems, either at the household level or at the government level. These sorts of things, you know, a lot of what you've heard, you know, 5 years ago, nobody had really was really talking about. So I think it's important to see this as a process, and I think it's important to, you know, continue to have evidence so that we can dream and so that we can evaluate and learn by doing.
So just one thought that occurred to me listening today, and something we never really came back to, was how does one connect the sort of sovereign risk instruments with the meso-level instruments, with the micro-level instruments? And I think some of the technologies that we were just talking about maybe point the way towards that actually being feasible. So let me first give you a quick example of when it's not done well. So I have to be careful here, because at the last Verdi event I attended, I mistakenly insulted a friend who I did not know had been involved in a project which I thought was poorly done. So hopefully nobody here worked on anything in Peru in terms of... did you? Okay. All right. So Peru has a program that's based on a very coarse area yield index. So they basically look at poor provinces, and it's basically intended as a local government kind of thing. And if a very coarse crop cut exercise suggests yields are low, then payouts are made to all farmers. And I remember talking, I was at a conference a few years back in Lima, and the Minister of Agriculture said, this is really a stupid program because, you know, farmers are all compensated the same. It doesn't have any behavioral effects because if I invest more, I don't get any additional protection. I may not even know that I'm protected, or I may not believe that it exists. But if we start thinking about more sophisticated measurement, and maybe that's based on satellite-based systems, one could imagine having a kind of a more unified approach where a satellite-based measure triggers a payment maybe at the sovereign level if things are really severe. But that same information infrastructure could potentially be made available for farmers who want to top it up, or a municipality or a bank that wants to insure a portfolio. And if we start thinking about the resolution of the product, right, if it's going to be for an entire county or municipality like Alejandro was showing us, you know, you're sort of aggregating up pixels. But if you actually have the model there that's appropriate for a region and you've got a microfinance lender that's in a corner of that municipality and that municipality, you can sort of downscale off the same thing. And or similarly, for the Peruvian Minister of Agriculture, you could say, well, if you actually had good yield estimation and potentially you could do it at sort of fairly high spatial resolution, then a farmer could get this sort of baseline protection maybe from a government scheme. But if that farmer wants to invest more and wants some protection for that investment, they can actually buy top-up insurance, but runs off the same information infrastructure. So I think there's something out there. I mean, Daniel's inviting us to dream. So if I were dreaming, I think finding a way to take advantage of this scalable technology. I know the work we do, we're already aggregating up pretty high-resolution satellite stuff. And you can get, you know, precision agriculture uses super small pixel size, about the size of this stage, right? And so I think there's a technological way. And the final comment I would make in terms of subsidy and ultimately trust in products, I mean, maybe if the government says, look, when things are really terrible in this region, we're on the hook anyway, so we're going to do what Daniel suggests, and we're going to buy an insurance policy for everybody in this community. And then that becomes a base level of coverage for everyone. And then people can say, well, my government's buying this. Then they can see if it works. And then if they're the more entrepreneurial, if they want to say, well, actually, I want to expand my scope of crop cultivation, I'm going to take a loan, and I just don't want this baseline protection that maybe feeds my family in the worst circumstances, but actually gives me some additional protection, not when yields are 30% of normal, but when they're worse than 60 or 70% of normal, then maybe you start to see a subsidy, which by the subsidy I mean the government purchase of that base sort of tail risk contract, maybe that becomes a subsidy which actually helps to build a market for sort of other layers of risk. So anyway, I think that's something I've been thinking about from a lot of comments today as something to a challenge, I think, to all of us that are still working on this, you know, as we move forward. So
I don't know who closes our event.
I can do it. So just thanks a lot, and I wish everybody a good way back home, and see you maybe in 2 or 3 years to have a new kind of workshop. Okay, thank you.